Actually, I'm sorry.
How about we take this knife here?
Uh-oh, what, the dog get in there or something?
The dog's got my headphones.
Okay. Hello and welcome back to Street PX, a street photography podcast where we cover street photography, documentary photography, and photojournalism. You got me here, your friendly neighborhood podcaster, Casper, joined by my friend and colleague,
Jim Watkins. How you doing, folks?
We got amazing photojournalist and local Bay Area shooter, Dwayne Newton, with us here today.
Good to be here.
We're happy to have you, bud. We just got a couple of quick things we want to throw out. First, just a quick reminder. Jim, you want to throw the exposed at him again?
Oh, that's right. We're having a large group exhibition at the Harvey Milk Photo Center. Starts December 8th and runs through January 22nd of 2017. It's about 52 images, street photography, from our group, the San Francisco Street Photography Group, and some amazing images in which Dwayne Newton here, our guest today, was one of the helped to curate.
Yes, so one of our honorable judges. I know that job was not easy.
No. There is an opening reception coming up December 8th, a free wine, free food. So just come on out at the Harvey Milk Photo Center. It's 50 Scott Street in San Francisco. Join us, and we'll be happy to have you there.
You know, we got a link in the show notes if you want to learn more, see who the artists are, and get links to more of their work. Additionally, something Street PX wants to do for the upcoming holidays, doesn't matter, you know, what you believe, what you celebrate, we want to send pictures. We want people to send pictures back and forth to one another. So we're going to be bringing in a secret print exchange through the Street PX Lounge. This is a way for our listeners, ourselves, and the rest of the Street PX crew. What we want is anybody that's participating, we're going to apply a number to everybody and mix those up, pair two people up, and then right around the holidays or the cuff of the new year, you'll have a print coming into your mailbox and yours would be going out to another lucky photographer. So it's just an interesting spin on the trading of prints approach that a lot of places do. And we want to share all of our work with each other.
Yep, sounds like a great idea.
Yep, so if you want to find out more or participate, head over to the Street PX Lounge, join us there, and there's a poll right at the top where you just select, and then more information will be provided afterward.
Sounds good. Now, Casper, why don't you tell them about how we were recognized recently?
Oh, yeah, yes.
Yeah, talk about that, man.
It makes me smile. It seems Street PX is being noticed. Or at least on this particular scale, recently we have been featured. Would you call that the word there, Jim? Featured.
I would call that the word. Yeah,
I like that word. On the International Journalist Network, we're actually one of seven podcasts that they are recommending for photojournalists and visual storytellers. We really appreciate you there for doing that, and it's a feather in the hat, isn't it?
Yeah, that it sure is. Thank you, guys.
Cool. All right, enough with all that. Let's get on into the show. And today we have, like we said a while ago, the one, the only, Dwayne Newton joining us in Street PX Studio.
Thank you.
How's the last few weeks been for you?
Good. I've been fairly busy winding up an event I had, a photo exhibition, and shooting some more assignments, unexpected assignments, and looking for other ideas on assignments. The exhibition I put together took quite a long time. It was quite a bit of work. And so I'm kind of in a vacuum right now of okay, where to turn next, what to do. And so there's small things that have been popping up that have kept me busy.
Well, before we move to that, what recent project did you just get done with? Or the show, rather?
The Art of Fire.
Yes.
I was approached by a man named Tony Stefani. He's president of the San Francisco Firefighters Cancer Prevention Foundation. And he said, I want to do an exhibition called The Art of Fire. And that was it. It was basically, it was like a snipe hunt. Go find those images that represent the art of fire, the drama of firefighting. And so I said, okay, All right. But they, I thought it was any fire, anywhere. And they said, no, it has to be San Francisco. And so that narrowed the selections down to a smaller group of images to pick from. Plus, I had to find those images that were good. I didn't want to put any crap up on the walls.
Right.
A little bit of a standard there.
Yeah.
Now, can I interject here for the audience here? You are a retired firefighter from San Francisco.
Yes, 26 years.
26 years, and you just retired not too long. How long have you been on retirement now?
June 17th this year.
You almost got that clock down to the month, hour, minute.
Yeah, it was 0800 hours on the 17th. And that same.
Okay, so I didn't mean to interject.
No, it's fine.
Make sure everybody knew where you're coming from on this.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, man.
So I started the hunt. I looked at my own images, but I didn't want it to be all about me. And so I just got online and went through Instagram and Flickr and looked for those images, thousands of images. I contacted people I knew who knew photographers and looked at their work. And I looked at thousands of bad images. Not bad, but they weren't up to the standard that I wanted. And then I would see one that would be spectacular. So I'd have to figure out how to contact this photographer. And in one case, the photographer was in Brazil. And people were scattered, all over the place. In the end, we got 22 photographers total. The San Francisco Chronicle got wind of it, and they jumped on board with their photographers, and they gave me 500 images to choose from. And there were some amazing shooters out there that have some very dramatic fire images. And so I'd contact them, and I had a pretty good success rate in getting people to respond to showing their images. Initially, some people were skeptical. A couple people said, no, because they didn't think it was going to go anywhere. And I asked,
really?
Yeah. Initially.
Really? I'm surprised. Yeah.
It's a hell of a thing to naysay on.
Yeah. I think they, I'm not sure what they were thinking, but, when it hit the Chronicle, I made sure I sent them the content of that article and say, I wish you could have been here and part of this.
It made the front page of Flickr.
That's right.
It was a headline. Show that they were really pushing too for it. So
one of the photographers worked at Yahoo, which I didn't know.
Oh, that's handy.
And he told his bosses how I found the images, and they got very excited because I'd used Flickr quite a bit to find some of those images. Leah Garchuk in San Francisco Chronicle, she ran an item about my hunt for images, and I got some pretty good responses from that, particularly the guy, Joshua Lacuna, who shot the tintypes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Those were gorgeous.
Yeah. And he shot those firefighter portraits with an 8x10 camera and a 7,500 watt second flash unit. It was like a small subnuclear blast in a small space.
Oh, my God.
Because the ASA on it is like 0.06. So.
Supernova.
Yeah, essentially.
But it worked out because those images were, there's few words. You have to see it.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of those things. It's like certain types of prints, like metal prints. You have to see it to get a feel for the look.
Yeah.
That was an amazing event. Great turnout, too.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. We had a Rolling Stone photographer named Jay Blakesburg, and he had a massive fire across the street from his house in the city, and he shot some great pictures of that. And so he jumped in, and his images are actually going to be used for the next event in March at the Terry Gallery for the foundation.
Oh,
that's okay. Going to be a second round of the same images from Art of Fire. And where's that going to be exactly again?
Terry Gallery's in San Francisco. It's at Howard and First. This is going to be the fundraiser. And it's going to be, I would call, the bow tie wearing crowd.
Mm-hmm.
The Gettys and that sort of crowd are going to be there.
Black Tie Affair.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Some of the images will be auctioned off as a fundraiser.
Cool. And the proceeds to?
Firefighter Cancer Foundation.
Yep. And we're going to link into that because they were recently ranked in the top list of charities and organizations here.
That's right.
Yeah.
They do good things. and preventing the keeping firefighters safe would be the overall phrase, and making the industry aware of the things they're doing that are could potentially harm firefighters.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Better equipment, better training, and just awareness.
Now, they had a pretty big hand following the 9/11 situation too, right?
Yes, they did. As far as our crews going to New York, we did have some crews who on their own went. We didn't send an official group, but I guess about 15 or so firefighters went to help with the recovery at 9/11. Mm-hmm. And they flew in and they worked on the pile and recovery. Yeah, and you know, everyone wanted to do it. You felt you wanted to be there, but not everyone could be there.
Feasibility.
Yeah, apparently they had, you know, logistics and taking care of everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
I read, because I was telling the folks before, I had actually volunteered to go out there, and they couldn't take me because there's just too many folks in there.
Yeah.
Too many people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which says a lot about the true heroes of the country, the ones willing to drop things, so much so that they couldn't even accept everybody that wanted to help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and speaking of events, Dwayne, I mean, you have just this interesting portfolio of events that you have covered as a photojournalist. I mean, I'm looking at this, you know, and I'm just salivating at these places that you've had the opportunity to shoot. And I'm looking at one, the Sri Lanka tsunami. Back in 2005, how did you get down there in the first place? And you know, what? Tell us about that experience.
Well, the reason why I ended up there was it goes back to when I was in college, and I applied for a job at a newspaper in Santa Barbara, and I ended up getting the job, and I became the photo editor of the newspaper.
Okay.
And a lot of the people I worked with at that paper, Santa Barbara News and Review was the name of the paper, and it was the other side of reporting for a pretty conservative area of Santa Barbara. You had the Santa Barbara News Press and the Santa Barbara News and Review, and they considered us a bunch of commies, basically, which we were. But a lot of those people, we were still in contact, and they've gone on to amazing things. Joan Walsh was the editor when I was there.
And
Joan Walsh is now the political editor of The Nation, and she was in Salon.com.
I knew that name sounded familiar when you said it. I was like, yeah. Who is? Yep.
John Miller, art director. She was art director for Esquire, San Francisco Chronicle, et cetera, et cetera. Jeff Greenwald was the feature editor, and Jeff Greenwald called me, and he's an Oakland writer, travel writer. And he called me immediately after the tsunami and said, just out of the blue, it was like a Wednesday or Tuesday, I think. And he said, do you want to go to Sri Lanka? And I said, what? He said, what are you doing? And I always said, oh, I'm busy, because you never know. Can I get a ride to the airport in Sacramento?
So I need help moving.
Yeah. So he said, but you have to leave Friday. And I'm like, you're kidding. So I had to get equipment. I had to get my shots. I had to get tickets, you know, and it was.
They covered the expenses.
Yeah, they covered expenses, but I had to put everything together on the back end in order to, because I had no help. And I flew in to Colombo, and I realized after all that preparation, nobody had thought to make arrangements to meet me at the airport. So I was basically stumbling around in Sri Lanka.
Nobody standing there with a sign saying Newton.
No. So I had to call back to the States from Sri Lanka, from the local phones, with a big crowd around me. And I managed to get to the hotel, and I walked up right when my friends walked up, and the organization was Mercy Corps out of Portland, Oregon. They're a non-religious NGO. Okay. And, you know, I walked in, they said, you're heading out tomorrow. And we spent about 3 weeks. We drove about 2,500 miles around the island photographing. It was astonishing. There was 50,000 dead in Sri Lanka. And we were covering all aspects of it, from the Queen of the Seas train accident, the largest train accident in the world. I think over 1,000 people were killed when the train was hit by a tsunami. It was a holiday train. It was packed with people, and the tsunami hit it at the worst possible spot on the coast. It was the one spot where the train was right next to the coast. All of Sri Lanka had stopped right there when the tsunami hit. And so, and we went up to Tamil territory, Tamil Eelam, mm-hmm. and we went through the front lines, and it was a ceasefire at the time, and we interviewed the Tamil Tiger military members because there was allegations of the relief supplies and discrepancies in distribution, and which was true. And in the end, the Sinhalese government went in and wiped out the Tamil Tiger army shortly after the tsunami because they had been weakened by the not very much, and the differences were striking. So we got to see quite a bit, and those photographs were used by Mercy Corps in their efforts to assist recovery.
Mm-hmm. Now you had arrived there right after, directly. Okay, yes. So you're talking a week, few days.
I would say it was 5 days.
5 days.
Yeah.
So the true thing of the reality of it.
Yeah, there was definitely. Yeah,
the pieces weren't even really beginning to be picked up yet.
No, there was still a lot of damage. I remember going. We had to go across bridges that were destroyed, and so we had to get out and walk. And at one point, I was I had hooked up with a Danish demining group. You know, since they were in a civil war, there were landmines everywhere, and part of the coverage I did was the landmine and recovery. The tsunami washed mines all over the place, and so there were mines where there shouldn't be mines.
Oh, whoa.
And they were in trees, they were on roofs, they were in wells, and so the demining groups were everywhere trying to make the area safe in order to go and do recovery. And so I remember I was walking in, it was a monsoon, and I was walking with this large crowd of refugees making their way across a bridge. And it reminded me of a famous photograph, I think from the Korean War, of a crowd of refugees flooding a bomb bridge and just trying to get to the mine site. And I spent a couple of days in a minefield with this group. And, you know, that was, yeah, I got a hand to those guys. I everywhere I stepped, they were just like jumping all over the place. And I was like, I wanted to crawl on all fours because there were mines everywhere.
And, yeah.
All active while you're there.
Yeah. Yeah. There's little from anti-tank to grenades to little anti-personnel mines.
Wow.
Yeah.
Any of them go off when you're around? Sorry.
No, thank God.
I have to ask.
No. I didn't know. The cows were stepping on it, which is even more terrifying. God. But I didn't
know. That's not funny, but it is at the same time.
No cows stepped on them when I was there, and I stayed away from the cows because they didn't know any better.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking at one of these mines now. I'm looking at one of the photos you took there, and the mines are smaller than I would have thought they would have been, but they must be pretty lethal. I mean, really.
Those are designed to injure, and so if you injure one, that's three or four people that have to get you out of there. They're designed to do damage to your leg or
shrapnel style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're small enough, but that's and they're cheap, so you can carry a lot of them and put them everywhere, and so I think those are Pakistani P4 mines.
Good Lord. And how long were you there?
About 3 weeks.
All right.
We had a Toyota Land Cruiser and a driver, and we went everywhere.
Oh, that's a good point. You had a guide. That have you finally found a guide that would help?
Yeah.
Or
yeah, I actually I touched base with the people there.
Uh-huh.
And they gave me a huge sum of money. They gave me a big pile of money and said, see you later.
Whoa.
And it was the local currency. And so I was, you know, the hotel was pretty nice, but it was full of journalists and NGOs. But once we left Colombo, we were staying in, you know, we never knew where we were staying.
Right.
Yeah. And there's some pretty funky places we had to stay in.
And you're also in pretty much a disaster zone. So you don't know what kind of condition any of the places are going to be either. Was there like people that was guiding you or trying to take you to certain types of places, or?
we had to be careful. We had to be remain nonpartisan in coverage because we didn't want some aspects to be shown. People had their own motivations for taking us to certain areas.
That's where I was wondering if there was any like propagandizing or anything going on.
And we had to be careful about associating with the military. You couldn't use helicopters, which was a drag because it would have been far easier to fly to some of these places.
Right.
When we were in Tamil Tiger territory, we had to be careful about what we said and what we covered because they were in a ceasefire. One of the photographs I wish I had taken when we were crossing into the no man's land, there was the Sinhalese guard post from the Sri Lanka government, and then there was the Tamil Ulan guard post, and you cross this no man's land. And the Toyota Land Cruiser we had, the guy had a Sinhalese like sport club sticker on his front window, and I'm like, you know, dude, cover that up. And because, you know, it's like we didn't want to get, you know, thrown into a hot box because of, you know, this guy had to stick on a car. But the Tamil Tiger soldier who was guarding the post, he was on my right. We were driving by. I looked at his face and the intensity of the look on his face. I know why he was chosen to be a guard because he looked like he was ready to die. For his cause. I mean, I wish I had taken that photograph. I can still see it. The light on his face, it was, and the intensity of his gaze.
The one that got away.
Yeah, yeah. But I was like, you know, we're in a no man's land, and I've learned my lesson about taking pictures of no man's land before in Central America.
Yeah.
So
that look could have resulted in an action that was unpleasant.
Yeah, well, yeah. You just, you know, you whip out a camera and suddenly it changes the dynamic.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The suicide bombing came from Sri Lanka, the original concept of suicide bombers.
Oh.
Yeah, back in the day, in the 80s. As we know it. And although, you know, the World War II, you had your suicide squadrons, but as far as the suicide bombings that we know where humans strap bombs to themselves, that came from the war in Sri Lanka.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. Hmm.
I'm trying to think. What was the movie with Marlon Brando where he had went to...
Apocalypse Now.
Yes. Yeah. With who was the photographer that had no film?
Dennis Hopper. Dennis Hopper.
Yep. Had no film in it, but he was still... He had just like a neck full of cameras.
Yeah.
You know, Dwayne, you mentioned the face that got away, but you did capture some beautiful images of people. Some of them were happy. Some of them were just pensive. How was it like interacting with the people with your camera?
Yeah, I had when I got back, I had a show at the World Affairs Council, and one of the people in the audience, an instigator, as it were, he said he didn't accuse me of being a voyeur, but he was kind of implying, you know, what did the people think about you taking these images? And the difference is that they're not inundated with media as we are. And the destruction was so unbelievable. It was so incredible. I mean, and this was just Sri Lanka. I remember the Indian Ocean tsunami.
Right.
Hundreds of thousands dead. And a phenomenon that has never been seen. And nobody would believe it if there were no evidence with photographs. And so they said, come see, I would have people pulling me to show me, you know, what had happened to them. The woman standing, I have a picture of a woman standing in front of her house, and she wasn't talking, but she was just wandering around. And I guess she had lost six children and in that house. And you could see the look on her face. She just, a gaze that just went nowhere. And there was a woman who was sweeping, and she was sweeping in front of her house, what was left of it. And then as far as you can see in the background was just destruction. And you know, these were not huts in any sense. They were concrete and, you know, wood and metal. And the intensity of the tsunami that struck at certain points along the coast just absolutely destroyed, just crushed. you know, anything recognizable as a home or a village or a town or a city.
Now, the 50,000 you spoke of, that was Sri Lanka only, but the tsunami in and of itself across the board, wasn't it like a 100 and some odd total affected?
I think it was like a 250,000.
That's what I thought. Yeah. It was probably one of the top disasters in human history.
Yeah. 250,000 at least.
Yeah.
That's a conservative estimate.
But the biggest hit was in that location.
No, it was in Banda Aceh in Indonesia.
Oh, yes.
Banda Aceh.
Thanks for that correction. Yes.
And Thailand got hit. They lost about 3,000 or 4,000. There was somebody killed in Africa, all the way on the other side of the Indian Ocean. There was like one person.
Because everything kind of, when the quake hit, everything went opposite directions.
Yes.
Now, as far as like doing this type of photojournalism, is this the type that you always wanted to do in conflict zones or disaster areas? That's what drove you to this?
I was 15 years old. I can tell you the time and date I decided to do this. I was 15 years old. It was April 28th, 1975.
Mm-hmm.
I had some connections through the war. My brother had gone over as a soldier and lost his arm over there. My father quit the military because they were trying to send him to Vietnam. And so he retired. He was a naval officer. And he quit after 28 years. But anyhow, the war was ending, and
he was on the submarines too, right?
He was in submarines in World War II.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Something else. I should add, my father, his gravestone says, "The hell I can't." And so that has driven me, because he actually said that.
That's a great phrase.
The hell I can't. The preacher doesn't like it on the headstone, but
it's his choice.
That's what I live by. And so, the war was ending, and they had this documentary, and it was reflecting on the war, and they showed the different aspects of the war, and they showed the media, and they showed these guys and the era of life and look, and the large picture agencies, Reuters, AFP, and all those, which have now been all bought up by seemingly Getty.
And that's kind of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. But, and they showed these guys cruising around, taking pictures, getting paid, and seeing the world. And I had grown up seeing a lot of history in San Francisco. And I immediately said, well, that's what I want to do, just like that.
That looks like fun.
Just like that. Because they were taking pictures. And I was kind of a geek when I was a kid. And I had all these different interests. But the one thing I knew, even as a very small child, I didn't want to sit behind a desk. Mm. I knew that. And even I 6 years old, I just knew it. I said, there's no way. And so that was the solution.
You were the kid that was just run, 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 run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I had a PE exam, and they blocked away like 2 hours. School was ending. It was April. And so they had those little books. They had little big book of, you know, fill in the blank. In this case, photography. And so I grabbed it and went to take the PE exam, and that took about 30 seconds, and then I had to kill that time. And so I was looking at this book, and I was interested because of science and art mixed together, and I could, you know, and that satisfied what I was looking for. And so my father found this summer camp for photography. It was run by the Army, of all things.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And I went there for 2 weeks, and I got my first camera, a Canon FTB, and some of the people who were running the camp were Army photographers with great stories of being shot down, and I got to fly in a glider at the camp.
For real?
Yeah, towed by a car.
Oh my God.
Taking pictures from it. When you're 15 years old, that's pretty exciting.
Hell yeah.
So I started taking pictures, and I became the newspaper photographer for this high school, and I built a little darkroom, and I decided I wanted to go to a photography school when I was 15, and I picked a school, and everything I did after that was directed towards photography.
Well, you are it's lining out this path.
Yeah. Yeah.
Haven't even got the license yet.
Yeah. No. I do. I have it on my car.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
Now, you went to the Brooks Institute, right?
I went to Brooks in Santa Barbara, and I was always told, you're at the wrong school. I said, no, because Brooks will teach you how to shoot anything. Metal, glass, people. And so you always had something to fall back on if you, you know, you can be a great photojournalist, but a great photojournalist knows how to shoot anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Light and shoot, and is not intimidated by assignments. And so, and that gave me the flexibility I needed when I worked at the newspaper, which, as you see now, some of the best photographers for the media are people who can shoot anything.
Yep. And it's the ability to observe.
Yes.
I think that's key, and that's difficult to teach.
It is.
If not impossible in some cases. Some time back, we were chatting about when you were down in South America.
Central America.
Central America. I'm just curious if you want to tell the story of your experience down there, particularly when you were on the dark road.
Oh, well, there's a couple of dark roads I drove down. I'll tell the first half of how I ended up in Central America. In 1983, I was... I left a newspaper, and some of the people, one of our reporters had gone down to Central America, George Thurlow, and he got shot, and he survived. And there was a guy named Kevin McKiernan who showed up, and he showed me his work, and I was blown away. And I didn't know who he was at the time, but it turns out Kevin McKiernan was the only photographer who was at Wounded Knee in 1973 who stayed with the entire siege. And he was pretty well known, but he came in real quiet. We thought he was CIA, but his photographs were astonishing. And he had some pretty good insight. And so 1983, I got in a small sum of money. It wasn't very much. It was like $900. But I used $900 to get to 13 countries. But I by sailboat.
That's being very efficient.
By sailboat?
What? Yeah. Sorry, I was still focused on the money. Sailboat? I didn't even catch the sailboat part.
Well, the secret is you could travel around the world for free if you know how.
Right.
And one of the biggest influences in my life was called The Seven Laws of Money, which came out of the Whole Earth Catalog. And one of the things they said in there, you don't need money to travel, you need friends. And so I took that to heart. And I got to 13 countries on $800. I didn't eat well.
A lot of ramen noodles.
Yeah. But I ended up, I was on a sailboat going to Tahiti, and I didn't like the captain. He's all right on shore, but at sea, he was a maniac. And so I got off in Panama and went overland up to Nicaragua and stayed in Nicaragua for a while and just roamed there and sending work back to the newspaper, and it was hard then because we didn't have the digital technology. We had those drum scanners, and things were slow, and you had to ship things. And so I went all over the place. I went to trade unionist events, went to cultural events. I went up to the front line managed not to get blown away. And then ended up going overland all the way to the Texas border and going back to the States. And then in 1986, the peace conferences were in Escapulas. I was back in Santa Barbara, and a photographer named Jason Blybtroy and Jeremy Bigwood, we were going to take two Toyota Land Cruisers and drive from Santa Barbara to Honduras. And so we did. We drove down to the peace conferences in Escapulas with the five presidents of Central America were meeting to negotiate a peace for the area. And that was pretty incredible. It was a media crush. And to see, I think it was, I can't remember all of the names, but we were at this giant cathedral and photographing these presidents. And our next plan was to go into a Contra camp. And the Contras were anti-communist fighters supported by the Reagan administration. And we were going to go photograph the Contras, as it were. And the two LA Times photographers, Richard Cross and Dial Torgerson, had tried to go into that camp and had hit a mine and were killed. And so Jason and Jeremy decided we're going to go in there.
We're going to go further.
We're going to go. And so we were ready to do it. And you can't just drive right in there. It's overland. You got to take donkey and foot and, you got to have connections. And so we left the peace conferences and we were on our way through El Salvador, and we had a little problem. We had a little problem.
This is a small one.
A small one. We ran into an ambush, and I'm not sure who these people were because there were various groups running around. Paramilitaries, guerrillas. They could have been government troops because it was pitch dark, but they had guns. They stopped us on the road, and we had this Land Cruiser that had TV taped on the side, and that meant nothing. And we were, it was just me and Jason at that point.
Target vehicle.
Exactly. And so they were negotiating about, they couldn't decide whether to kill us. And I remember the conversation, yo quiero matar a ese gringos, which means I want to kill these guys. And the guy's like, no, he's pushing the barrel of the gun away. And I'm sitting there watching this going, I've got to step in here. I've got to intercede. And so we said, I said, yeah, you know, we have camera equipment. Don't you want to take a look at that? We got a lot of it. And so suddenly they were distracted. Oh. And so they were climbing in the vehicle. And so I had to get into the vehicle in order to move the seat for them. I was being very helpful. And I looked and Jason was at the driver's seat.
This hard top or soft top?
Yes, a hard top. And I said, Jason, go. And he was on the same thought plane. And so the engine was still running. We jumped in, ducked down, slammed on the gas, drove off. And we were waiting for gunfire. It never came. And we realized why, because a quarter mile up the road, there was a government roadblock. And if they had fired on us, then the government would have gone out after them and, you know, bought down whatever superior forces on them. I was livid. I wanted to go back and get those guys.
Well, you're saying that they were trying to force you to the ground, too.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The guy said, well, I should back up. Kevin McKiernan, the guy who was at Wounded Knee, he had said that if you're ever held at gunpoint and they tell you to get on the ground, do not get on the ground. And there was a guy in 79, a reporter, is filmed, and it was in the film Under Fire. They actually replicated that scene, but it was, his name is Bill something. I forget, but he laid on the ground and one of Somoza's National Guard shot him as he laid on the ground. And so it's better to be shot standing upright. And so when the guy told me to get on the ground, I said, no. I said, it's raining. It's wet. He also told me to give me your wallet. And I said,
it's wet.
No, I have a picture of my girlfriend in there. I said, yo tengo una foto de mi novia allí. He's looking at me like I'm insane, but I'm alive.
There's the key.
Because you establish a grain of humanity and maybe a bit of madness when you argue with somebody who's there to kill you. And they always imagine, you know, what and the way things should go. And if you take the chance and change the direction of that, it might make a difference. You know, who knows? He could have shot me. He's like, all right, I'll take it all. Bam. You're on the ground and you're dead and I got your wallet. But that's not what happened.
And you're in an element right now where it is kind of accepted the fact that this is just a potentiality. So why not? Hell, I can't.
Yeah,
let's stand up, right?
Yeah, let's add another chapter to this book. And it worked. Jason, I was done. I said, I'm going to Costa Rica to the beach. I'll see you later.
Signing out.
Yeah. That was enough. And I, you know, there were other things that I had to deal with that just like, that's it. I'm out. And so Jason went to Don Lee on his own and he got in. And he got photographs and he got out alive. And right after that, Eugene Hassenfuss, the CIA contractor, was shot down and captured by the Sandinistas. And guess who had the only current photos of Contras? Jason. And it made his name. And he became a bureau chief in Tegucigalpa, Honduras. And then he went on to Hanoi. And now he has a video business in Bangkok.
And
New Zealand. So he's doing great. But he made the choice to go in. He was making $10,000 a month off stock.
Man.
Wow. That was a lot of money though.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, man. What is it they say? What's the phrase? have camera be there.
More like have cojones be there.
Yeah. Have the balls walk on in.
Yeah.
Can you describe like the adrenaline rush that you're getting through all of this? Like, I mean, is that even able to put in words the feeling?
You definitely feel you know, activated, alive. I mean, as evidence that I went into the fire department after all this.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
And so
you became the adrenaline junkie thereafter.
Yeah, for 26 years. And so, you know, it's like if you, there's situations where you walk into, in order to get the photograph, you can't have fear. Mm-hmm. You have to look at the larger picture and look at, basically look at the end goal and then work your way backward. I want to get this picture and then all the other things that's necessary to build the pyramid toward and getting that pinnacle picture. You have to do that, plan mm-hmm. for it. And having fear is not necessarily something that's going to get you that picture.
Right.
Or where you want to be.
True. Exactly.
Yeah.
Is yeah. that, was that what you say would be kind of your top adrenaline rushed or feared moment while you're down in Central America? Or you got any other crackers you want to throw?
There are some other things that happen.
Oh, bring them. Well, there's a mic and it's waiting.
One of the things that when you had got up in the morning, you didn't drive first on the road. You always wanted to get behind a truck or a bus, which sounds cynical, but if there's a landmine, they're going to hit it first. And so you drive in the tracks. And landmines, I have that's one thing I do fear because they care not who they kill.
Yeah.
And so we would, you know, and I'd be driving the tracks. And then in 1984, and since there was the war going on in Nicaragua and Contras, to get from Nicaragua to Honduras, you had to cross a no man's land. There was no roads. And so you had to walk. And so there were three armies cruising around in this no man's land. And I was by myself with my gear and my backpack. And you're basically walking through a battlefield. And so as I was getting ready to leave the Sandinista base, a patrol comes in the brush. And the guy has a Russian machine gun. And he opens up in the direction where I'm going.
Oh, shit.
And it was loud as hell. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. He's shooting in the direction I'm going. And
oh, I see where, yep.
Yeah. And I'm going, holy. So walking through there and you see, you know, you had to, you know, it's like, hola, comrade. And it's like, oh, wrong army. So you had to pay attention to the insignia because there was Contras, Sandinistas, and Honduran army walking around in there. And that was not a good feeling because you never knew. And that was a constant thing. You had to be careful about which road, when you pull into roadblocks, you had to be careful about who was running that roadblock and know who they were, and you couldn't be carrying anything on you that would associate you with any particular side.
Yeah, so had to be completely neutral.
Souvenirs, if you had some Sandinista souvenirs, you know, and you'd be on a bus or something, and you see the whatever paramilitary army would come in, and they'd look at certain people, and they'd, you know, I was talking to this guy on a bus, and we had a great conversation for a couple hours. We pull up to a roadblock. Army comes in and they're going down the aisle looking left and they stop at him. They look at him. Bam. He was gone.
Wow.
And I'm going, who was I talking to?
Whoa.
So, you know.
Did you ever find out?
No. No, what are you going to say? It's like, hey, that's my friend.
Who is this guy?
So
I'm not with him, but tell me who he is.
Yeah, that's what you say. I don't know him. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I just sat here.
I've been talking to him for 2 hours. He hasn't. He hasn't paid any attention to me. So
they straight up just black bagged him. Just
gone. They just took him off the bus and, you know, it was like, you just go, okay.
Well, you know, as a photojournalist, I mean, do you get to a point where you ask yourself, what the hell am I doing here? Or does the adrenaline just feed upon itself and you want more and more?
No, you do ask yourself, what am I doing here? There'll be a moment where you look around and go, what the fuck am I doing here?
I have lost my damn mind.
That comes if you don't do that, then you have to put it in perspective. And but typically, it's after you get the photo that you start thinking about it. Not during. When you're trying to get the photo, there's nothing on your mind but getting the photo. But afterward, immediately afterward, you go, "Whoa, what did I just go through in order to get that photo?"
Yeah.
But you look at the photo, in a day as a film, you know, I know I got the photo.
Right.
But, you know, until you saw that film strip, you weren't sure.
That takes the whole darkroom, you know, situation into a whole different direction. Like that, the feeling you get whenever you see this stuff develop in front of your eyes, you're seeing stuff that you went through bullets over.
Yeah, we were doing color negative film, and we had a leaf scanner, which was the old AP scanner, in order to send images back to the States. Mm-hmm. So we had a hotel room where we convert the bathroom into a color dark room and wet process and dry it and then scan it. It took forever on those phone lines because you had to use a telephone hookup.
Oh, yeah, it's dial-up era.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
56K, 28A?
Oh, not even. This is pre.
Right.
Yeah.
This is just get it dialed, tone, and pray.
No, it's like World War II era technology.
Oh, my.
Because that's how they sent the wire photos. So nowadays, of course, it's so much easier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can do it on a cell phone. You know, take the picture, throw it to your cell phone. Or you're a fellow Fuji switcher.
Yeah.
So with that, now, have you tried that feature yet, the Wi-Fi connectivity?
Yes.
Isn't that handy?
Yeah, oh, my
God. Oh, it's so freaking handy.
We were shipping images back to the States from Sri Lanka, and that was the first experience I had with as far as being able to get images to the media immediately. After shooting them, it wasn't via cell phone, but it was, you know, you'd get back in the evening and use your laptop to transmit images right to the source.
So 2005, you were shooting digital at that time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I had a D1X.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That was a hefty machine.
It was, yeah. That's Fuji.
Yes.
Have to wait twice the power.
At least you can say you were armed. Yeah. Something that big is a blunt object.
It was, yeah, I had a lot of glass, and you're walking around hours and hours and hours with all that weight. There was one day I woke up and I just couldn't move.
I was just too much on the back.
Yeah, and I always carry a waist strap, and it was just, you know, it's like, you know, you're walking around for weeks with a camera bag on. You had to take it everywhere you went. And so, you know, and the amount of equipment I had to carry with me.
Yeah. How many lenses were you rolling around with?
I had four lenses.
Backup cameras, I'm sure.
Yeah, I had a backup camera.
Yeah.
And I had a Canon G. Something G, what, I can't remember the G or G series camera as a backup, and then flash because of the lighting. I had to have flash, and then batteries for that, the turbo battery, and it wasn't the small one. It was the one, the turbo compact that went underneath the camera.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah
and so it's
hefty.
Yeah, and so you know, and then the 28-70 Nikon lens, which is, you know, like a 64-ounce soda bottle.
A big gulp.
Yeah.
So you were really kind of like the Dennis Hoppering it.
Yeah, I had a lot of now. Crap. Hang on, yeah,
I've got that in my hand right now, man. Tell you right.
What's that, the big gulp?
Yeah, the big gulp, yep.
Yeah, mango cherry.
Right. Now, you worked with a number of different organizations. I was noticing Greenpeace is one of them.
Yes.
When it came up, you'd worked with Greenpeace there for a bit.
Yes, I was... when I was back in the 80s, Rainbow Warrior did actions off of Southern California, and I hooked up with Greenpeace and became one of their photographers. I was on the Rainbow Warrior for an action, and Navy was doing sonic testing, explosive testing, and so we went and interrupted that. And there was a guy named Saul Bloom, who was a coordinator. And so they would call me for these actions, and it would be very clandestine. Meet us at this house, and they'd say, meet us at this, you know, whatever. And because people were actively seeking to stop Greenpeace and their activist action. And so you'd show up at a house, and they would have the plan. They wouldn't tell you the plan. And Vandenberg was launching MX missiles at the time. And so we were creating radar deflectors with weather balloons. Because you can't launch a missile if there's a boat in the path. And so every radar signal had to be investigated. And so you had dozens of radar deflectors with weather balloons floating through the launch.
Like perimeter path. Or path, yeah.
They'd have to go investigate them. And so we we planned to do that. We built all these deflectors. Then we got in a massive storm offshore, and a Pacific Peacemaker was that boat. And so we never did get those weather balloons launched. And the Rainbow Warrior was an experience. The person who was killed when the French blew up the Rainbow Warrior in Tahiti was the photographer, because the darkroom was in the bow. And so they put two limpet mines. And when the first mine went off, everyone was scrambling around and the boat was sinking. And then he ran down below to save his equipment. And the second mine killed him. And he was the only fatality in that bombing by the French government.
Do you have any affiliate? Did you know him or?
No. Actually, he wasn't on board.
Okay.
When I was there.
And, oh, okay. So
yeah.
Different excursions. So
his name was Paolo. His name was Paolo, I believe. But I never met him. But I knew when they said he was killed, I knew why, because mm-hmm. of the location of the photography area in the dark.
Yeah.
Room. Yeah.
This goes to show how important and how true real danger that it is to be a journalist.
Yeah.
Then, now, you know, depending on how things play out, more so now.
Yes, it's true. There's the museum in Washington, D.C. is a fantastic museum. They have a wall of journalists who've been killed. I forget how far back, but when you see the scale of that wall and the number of names on it, and how it's expanded in certain years, you realize journalists have become a target. Mm-hmm. The days of putting press on your hat and, you know, running around like in some Under Fire movie where they're just waving plastic cards and,
like those MASH are, or whatever. Yeah. It's like, well, we're above or below the radar of these things no longer.
Those days are over. You're a kidnapped target.
Yeah. That's part of the warfare in and of itself, is the propaganda or diversion of journalism and coverage.
That's right.
Changing the storyline, changing the narrative to meet a particular issue or preference.
Yes. And nowadays, it's so much easier for people who have the desire to go off to do this type of photography to get themselves in trouble or get themselves killed because of it's, you know, you could just jump on a plane and fly to Turkey and show up at the border and just associate yourself with someone and off you go. And there's been a number of Western journalists who've done that and gotten themselves injured or killed or in trouble.
The CNN. The thing that just came out on CNN, the exclusive, the journalist that was under ISIS attack for 48 hours.
I saw that.
And documented it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you think that was probably terrifying because they were basically under siege and they were surrounded by people who, if they captured them, it's like, you can forget it.
Yep.
They would kill the soldiers and hold you hostage probably for a couple of years.
Well, they still have the one capture from 2 years ago, the journalist that they use in their films now.
Yeah. So, and it's so easy. A friend of mine who is in Pakistan, she worked for the Wall Street Journal, and she was friends with Daniel Pearl. And they had a dinner party at her place, and she was the last person to see Daniel Pearl. And you know the rest of what happened with him.
Yeah.
He was one of the first journalists that was they illustrated his execution. And so the dangers of getting the message out are larger now, but the necessity to get the message out is even stronger now.
Truth.
And so the way to figure out how to do it without becoming part of the story. And some people go into situations forgetting that you're there to cover the story, not become the story.
Yeah.
And you have to know what your limits are and know how far you can go in order to get that picture and know when to back off.
Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah. I know there were some big names on that wall. Journalists that died, photojournalists, you know, especially.
Yeah.
Because I know Robert Capa had to be on that list. He's one of my heroes.
Yeah, Robert Capa. Some of the people in Vietnam era.
Yeah.
Dickie Chappelle. the horse, not the guys, Larry Burroughs, those guys,
Sean Flynn. Yeah,
those guys.
Errol Flynn's son.
That's right. Actually. Yeah. And those guys who were shot down in that helicopter in Laos and disappeared.
Oh, yeah.
In 71, I think it was. And then the journalists who were killed in Central America, and then even some of the journalists who were killed in the Middle East and et cetera. So it's, mm-hmm.
This is a name drop episode right here with listeners.
Oh, yeah.
There's some plenty of research.
Know your history.
Exactly.
Know your history.
You have to. You really have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, it's important because you can learn from the history of others who've gone and done those things that you would like to do. And maybe you can advance forward what they intended to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what they sacrificed themselves for.
Now, when was the last time that you did an on location assignment like that? To that extent, say like the 2005 Sri Lanka, disaster or?
That was the last time I went overseas. For something. I've done a lot of local stuff.
Uh-huh. You were telling me that you were covering a KKK rally.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How horrific was that situation?
Actually, it was pretty... I can laugh about it in retrospect. There was a Nazi KKK skinhead rally, and it was up in Napa. And people think that, you know, California, how could it be? Well, it was the head of the Modesto clan was there, but nobody believed they would be there. And... so there was a large concentration of police and protesters, a smaller group of skinheads and Nazis. And we got wind, myself and my friend named Tony Marshall, got wind that the Klan was coming. And I didn't believe them. And so we left the security of the crowd and started walking up the road by ourselves. And eventually we were far enough away, we were the only two people on the road. And in the distance, I see about a dozen men walking towards me. And we stop and wait, and it's the Klan.
Oh, God.
I think the guy's name was Bill Albers, the head of the Modesto Klan. And he's got they're not wearing hoods and sheets, but he had on a cowboy hat that had all these pins on it, the Klan pins and Confederate flags. And he had the Klan.
Oh, the medallion symbol, thing. Yeah.
Yeah. With the cross with the blood drop. And, yes. And he had on a jacket that had that emblem on it, and then a big on the back it said Modesto Klan and his followers. And so there I was with Tony, who's got these long dreadlocks, and myself. And so we're looking at him, and I said, "So where are you going?" And they said, and I never forget this, they said, "We're on our way to practice our Christian right to get our message across." And so I fell in with them, and the all of us were walking, me,
Tony, like walking with them
and photographing and talking to them. I was going, "So, you know, what do you think's going to happen? You know, there's a large mob of people there that object to your very presence here." And, Albers was, you know, he, it was like the interview we're having now. Wow. You know, just us talking and, you know, he gave it answers, and I was writing, and I turned around and I'm like, "Where was my friend Tony?"
Oh, yeah.
He was gone. And I'm, "Jesus, I'm here by myself with the Klan."
Good God.
What? He's gone?
He's gone. And what he had done was he didn't like this situation. So he ran ahead, out of sight. And he told the mob, "The Klan is coming up the road." So the next thing I know, there was this guy. He must have been 6'5", and he had dreadlocks just as long. And he had this big stick. It was a gnarled piece of oak, and it was all twisted, and combat boots. And he was running full tilt up the road, like he was playing field hockey or something.
With a tree in his hand.
With a tree in his hand. And he didn't stop when he hit the Klan.
Oh, he went full bore.
He went full bore into him. Bam. Yeah, and the riot was on.
Oh, my God. And you're right in the thick of all of this.
Yeah. There's a photograph of me... in the middle of that riot, when one of the Klansmen was getting punched by a guardian angel, as it were. And the photograph, I'm being pushed back. I've got my hand up to prevent myself from, you know, being part of the punch. The guy's jaw is going to the left. His top of the rest of his head's going to the right from the punch. And it's a full extension punch. It was taken by a guy who, San Francisco State. and we became boat partners, as it were, later on, sailboat partners. And he had his photograph, but
good swing. Let's go sailing.
You know, and they were, there's just fish are flying, stuff was getting ripped. And so Bill Albers lost his cowboy hat at one point. And I was standing there with my friend Tony and some other guy. And we looked down and we realized, well, that's a souvenir.
There you go.
So I have some plan pins in my collection at
home. Oh, you did snatch it?
Yes, I do. I have some of those pins and some of that memorabilia from his cowboy hat. And strangely, after the police came and rescued the Klan and put him on a school bus, Albers saw me in the crowd, and he pulled down the window and he said, "I wasn't finished with my interview." He's got blood on his face. I said, "Bill, I think it's a little late." I'm,
you know, holy shit!
Yeah.
Did you finish it later?
No, I said, "Yeah, no, we're done, Bill. Yeah, you got your message across."
Yeah. I do. There is one question I am curious of. Did the gentleman with the tree connect?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
With the tree to a face?
Full impact.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Well, there was.
Was that Albers that threw it, caused him to throw his hat, or?
No, that came later, because it's a few dozen more people. The mob caught up with him. Mm-hmm. He was the first of the mob, and then the rest of them caught in it, turned into
just. But he was the first impact.
He was running full tilt.
Man.
Running point, man.
Yeah, he was.
Well, that's the right person to have out front. It's the battering ram to take down the door.
Yeah, I'll never forget that. And I was watching with my eyes were getting wider going, whoa, this is coming at me.
How long ago was this?
This is 1988, 89.
Okay, just to give an idea of the atmosphere of the nation and the world at that time.
There were skinheads in San Francisco.
Yeah.
There were Nazi rallies.
Anybody ever watched Sons of Anarchy? I mean... That's in Stockton.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that element is there.
Actually, I know one of the characters in there from the Sons of Anarchy.
Like,
one of the actors.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
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 Well, you know, hearing all this, life must be seem really tame for you nowadays, huh?
There's always something to get into. Yeah. There's always a story. I was photographing a World War II submarine in dry dock this last weekend.
Oh, yes.
And I was underneath that. And I just wanted to be there because my father was in submarines during the war, and I've been in touch with these people, and they said, yes, come on down. And one of the things as a photographer is if you've got an assignment where there's going to be a lot of other photographers there, show up early because sometimes they'll let you in sooner without.
Yeah.
Yeah. In this case, it was, they said, we're going to take you guys on a tour. It's just two of us before the 30 others showed up, and we got full run of the place. And got some images that nobody else could get.
That's some good advice for you people out there. It's good advice.
Show up early.
Yeah. Early bird gets the worm, and that is no more true than in photography.
That's right. Yeah.
What was it? I was watching, this is a complete tangent, but Nightcrawler, the movie with Jake Gyllenhaal. And,
yeah.
She's a creepy, scary son of a bitch. but that does not negate the point. You know, get there, be there before anybody else, and then have your internet ready to send that shit off the wire.
Yes, yes. And, you know, you get those images and, you know, meeting deadlines is also important. Being on time, of course, because if you're not on time, you're not going to get the picture.
Of course.
I worked for Associated Press in San Francisco, and, part of the thing was, you know, you had to be there. You had to get the shot. And you had to get in and get out. And assigning yourself, even if you're not working for an agency, to something where you have to get in and get the best photograph and get out, and many different situations is incredible training to be able to pretty much handle anything. You can't be intimidated, but you walk in a funky lighting situation or a hostile crowd. You have to get the picture. To show up back at the agency, I didn't get it. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's your reputation that's on the line, too, and that's gold standard.
And they'll have to go pick it off some other agency, Reuters or
Oh, like the Sun-Times did the World Series picture?
Yeah. It's like, yeah, we'll have to go to somewhere. And so the clients of the AP will say, well, we'll just have to go to somebody else. And, you know, if that particular bureau continues to do that, it's not a good thing. New York gets upset. So you got to show up with the image.
Being in the industry this long and really prevalent during the 80s, and have you found that the industry is, I mean, how much has it changed and what parts have changed most boldly?
The biggest part is the advent of pretty much a digital device in everyone's.
What is that?
That's my cell phone.
Oh, okay.
Bob Marley. It's great, which is perfect timing because the iPhone has become a device that's capable of producing news. And so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For better or for worse.
Yeah. You can basically produce a movie, broadcast quality movie or media quality images with an iPhone for publication. And now the media outlets and other of your potential clients know this. And so they can give somebody an iPhone and say, go out, do a story, and they will broadcast that or produce it or print it. And all it costs is this. And so the industry's been undercut heavily by the number of digital images out there are the royalty-free stock.
Right.
Yeah.
And just the number, the ease of being able to take a photograph there, the learning curve has been flattened. And so people can buy a camera, a point and shoot that they don't have to think in order to take a photograph. And so now they can hire one person, a reporter, give that reporter, and they don't, the picture quality has gone down in some cases.
Well, that's the key. It's not just about the loss of your photographers on staff.
Yeah.
It's your photo editors that you're also removing, the people that actually sift through to find a worthy image. Yes, anybody with a cell phone can document and cover, but there's still an ability to narrate and create a narrative around a single image.
It is. And the upside of this digital explosion, as it were, and the difference was back when I got started, you had print media was your outlet. And so a lot of that print media is gone. Newspapers, Life Look, publications, a lot of newspapers have failed. Oakland Tribune, you know, we used to have multiple papers in this town.
East Bay Express or something bought them up, didn't it?
Yeah. There's hardly any print media left. And even those have been, their staffs have been cut. And so the traditional newsroom has been, flatlined, if you will. But the upside is there's many more outlets for your images online. And there's some very viable and valid publications and ways to get your images out there that can make a difference.
I definitely agree with that point. Mm-hmm. My concern is the fragmentation of news reporting, and more choices is generally a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Great for us as photographers and getting our work to various boards. But I think it also
double-edged sword.
It's a double-edged sword that persistently increases fragmentation and bubble reality.
Right.
Case in point, what we just dealt with at this election, and having so many places to find your information allows you to more easily adapt your information to your world and not know what the actual goings-on are. I know that's a long way of saying, but do you know what I'm saying?
I absolutely get that. Again, when I came of age in the age of photojournalism and journalism, there were only 3 or 4 TV channels. And so everybody would show up to work or school the next day and they'd be talking about the same shows. And everyone talked about, you know, the publications, the large publications. And there were only a handful. And then in the regional publications, the newspapers, everybody read a newspaper. And so the information sources were fewer. However, the slant of that publication or that outlet, with limited numbers, you could direct an entire population with, and they had no other outlets for their information unless they conjured it up themselves.
There's that double-edged sword.
Yes.
That's
And so now we have all these fragmented sources of information. So people can go get the information necessary to make a decision pretty much anywhere they want. you can go anywhere now and find a community of like-minded people.
Multiple platforms out there for all ideologies.
So, and then, and so if you want to go to certain type of images, you know, customize what you look at, your news sources. But nowadays, there is no excuse to not know what's going on when you can, if you have any digital device, you can customize it to have, access to those publications, give you a broad spectrum. One of the best publications for giving an idea overall of what's going on in the world is called The Week magazine. And The Week is a summation of the week's news by multiple sources of information. And it's short, concise, and they cover all bases. They're nonpartisan. And I gave up on the other publications strictly for that, because it gives you a cross spectrum of the world in easily digestible bits. And so you can have an idea of what's going on. It's not as picture heavy as I would like, but information wise. But, you know, there's ways to get the information to people so they can get a better idea, which to me, it's a mystery as to why we're sitting here today with what happened yesterday. And people are saying, well, you know, how could they not know? We've known for decades about, you know, the man who is now our president, and it's like, I don't get it. And this is when we'll be talking about this for the next 4 years.
Ignorance is not an excuse. It's not possible in an information age.
Yeah, you can say that again, bro.
Yeah. But it's, you know what? It's, ignorance is powerful.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, ignorance is another bit of change.
That's
as evident.
Yeah, and that's why journalists are here to attempt to break through that glass wall. And we can only hope that it's glass.
Yeah, you know, the thing about being a photojournalist is when you take that picture, what are you trying to convey by that picture?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're in your mind's editor of the image, and the way you take a picture of an event or a subject can determine how people feel about that. And so to remain neutral when you're taking that picture, you know, is something that is also part of the journalist creed. And sometimes it can be hard, especially if you're dealing with somebody who, you know, you naturally, it's natural instinct to go, I don't want to put this person in a good light, but you have to give them a chance, because you know, the freedom of speech is one of the rights of the Constitution, and everybody has a right to a voice. Just as the Klansman, he said his right is to speak. He's right. He can put his message out there.
Absolutely.
Disagree or agree.
You can't have it. You can't have only part. It's either all or nothing.
The ACLU defended the Nazis in Skokie, Illinois.
That they did.
And yeah. So, you know, we had the right to march and express, and the public didn't like it. It turned into a riot, but, you know.
Well, yeah.
You know what? I want to step back to Duane Newton Photography for a minute here. One of your iconic images, the guy on the bike with the American flag at Occupy Oakland.
Yes.
And we were talking about powerful images and what you're trying to convey. Can you talk about that image for a while? Because it's got a lot of traction.
That was taken at the massive march for Occupy Oakland when they took over the port. And beyond the lighting aspect of it, which caught my eye, it was the American flag conjures up emotions and different feelings. And so the idea of this guy on a bike riding around with an American flag in the middle of a protest, I mean, it's the right to protest. I mean, it had a lot of symbolism. It's hard to really convey as far as you have to put it in context. If you saw it independent of the caption, you would think it's a guy on a bike in a crowd with a flag. But when you put it in the context, it's a reminder of those many iconic photos of American flags. So, yeah, I don't want to say Iwo Jima, but you know, you think of those photos, like Stanley Forman's photo of in 1976, the Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph of American flag being used to attack an African-American man in the busing conflict of 1976, et cetera, et cetera. And so it brought up that emotion of a symbolism of the flag within the context of people expressing their right to protest. I'm not sure if it's making any sense, but it was also a fantastic lighting moment, a moment that, I saw this and I said, oh my God, look at that photo.
And you look at this, the sunlight is going through half of the flag. And so you're looking at it, that can represent transparency.
Yeah.
The other half of the flag can represent darkness or conspiracy. You know, there's a lot of symbolism in that image.
A few more seconds, the flag would have been in shadow. The light would have been different. It wouldn't have been as powerful a photograph. And so sometimes you see it and a good journalist sees it, gets that symbolism, that moment in their head and knows what it means and shoots it all within 1/250th of a second. And that is what makes the difference between a good photojournalist and just a photographer, is being able to shoot that image. I'm not sure if, you know, I'm all over the map with that question, because I hadn't really thought about it.
That is an incredibly powerful image, and I hope everybody goes to your website and takes a look at that.
Yeah, we'll be adding that one onto the show notes. Now, that said, it does hurt my heart, but that's about all the time that we have. We know you're busy. Jim, I know you're down in San Jose right now. I know you're busy. So I just thank you so much for, you know, taking the time out of your day and coming to talk with us.
Well, thank you. This is an incredible experience to be able to think and talk about what I've been doing with my life.
Yeah, just kind of puts you on the spot, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely, it does.
Well, that actually leads me to our common closing question, what we ask all of our guests that come on Street PX. You being somebody that's been well-traveled, this might be a tough one for you. Is there any place in the world that is a dream location you haven't shot yet that you want to go to?
I'd like to go to the ancient world, the Middle East, the antiquities, the culture. Unfortunately, a lot of that region is off limits because of the current conflict. But I would like to go there. I've had some experience in North Africa. It had a huge impact on me, Tunisia and Morocco, as far as interacting with the people and the ancientness of the culture. You know, we think the East Coast has got older culture than California, and then the European culture is old. But when you go to the Mesopotamia, that in parts of the world where it's just, we're talking 5,000 BC when they had a civilization, and there's still remnants around, and ISIS hasn't destroyed them. I'd like to go photograph there. Neck of the world, if you will, from probably India all the way over to
the army the Middle comes East. Around.
Yeah.
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 Just the true, what do they call that? The cradle of civilization.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah. It'd be so fascinating.
Yeah.
That would be a blast. Oh my God. Well, see, now that just means that we need to, get our tickets, sneak in.
Road trip.
Yes. Well, sky trip, then road trip.
And we got to get clearance from our wives.
Right, right. Well, let's go ahead and go around the table here. Where can people find more about your work, any past assignments that you've done, publishing?
My website is my name, DwayneNewton.com. You could just Google my name and you can see images. There's a porn star named Dwayne Newton and there's a lawyer named Dwayne Newton. So just look for those pictures that look like photojournalism.
And not porn.
But yeah, that would be, I mean, it's a lot of it was print. And
yeah.
So, the stock agencies I worked for, and some of the, editorial work I've done pops up online.
Right on.
Yeah.
Cool. We're, the date and location of the upcoming Art of Fire show as well.
It's March 4th, 2017. It's at the Terra Gallery. You can buy tickets for that, and it's a fundraiser. And I believe the tickets start at $100, and they go up to like $15,000 for a table.
There you go.
So it's going to be a
black tie affair.
Black tie event.
Yeah.
So, you know, leave the Nikes at home.
Yep. And Jim, where can we find you out there, bud?
Oh, as always, jimwatkinsphoto.com. And you'll find all my social media platforms linked to that. Also, I'm developing a new website just for strictly street photography. So I'll let you guys know when that's coming up.
Excellent.
All right.
And you can find more about me and all of my work at recasper.com. All my Facebook, Instagram, all of that's right through there. And then also check out streetpx.com. That's where you're probably listening to this episode at. But if not, if you're listening on iTunes, Google Play Music, iHeartRadio, head on over to streetpx.com. Check out this post and all of our other previous posts for more information on our guests, links, all of the show notes will provide links to artists that we have mentioned, as well as projects, photo books, what have you. And if you find it interesting, don't Google, just come to Street PX. Additionally, check out the Street PX Lounge. Remember, in the intro, we were talking about the secret print exchange. That's where you can participate, get involved in discussion, share pictures, share stories, your own photo essays. We're more about content than just photo dumping there. And last but not least, check us out on patreon.com/streetpx, where you can help fund this wonderful experience, the Street PX experience. And we thank all of you out there for helping us do that. It's the listeners that keep us flowing, keep us running, and bring in awesome guests in like Dwayne here today. And we couldn't be more appreciative of that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, sir. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, James.
Where are you going, Jim? You disappeared on me.
I'm getting ready. I'm heading up to San Francisco after
He's going down.
I'm packing now.
There we go. Now we're going to let everybody go. Thank you again. And yeah, we'll see you next week. Or no, we'll see you 2 weeks from now.
2 weeks from now.
All right.
Bye, folks.
Take it easy. Keep
shooting. Oh, exactly. Agreed. Great opening.
Right.
I'm getting my radio voice back.
Oh, you've always had it.